Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Labor and Employment Law and Religious Liberties Practice Groups, was recorded on Tuesday, June 2, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today we'll be talking about the recently decided Supreme Court case, EEOC versus Abercrombie and Fitch. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. I'm very pleased to welcome back return guest Michael E. Rossman. He is General Counsel at the Center for Individual Rights right here in Washington, D.C. He's going to give us some background on the case and then talk about the decision and its possible implications. He'll be giving us opening remarks of about 10 to 15 minutes, but then, as always, we'll be looking to you for questions, so please do be ready with those questions. With that, Mr. Rossman, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you. It's always glad. I'm always glad to be able to participate in a Federalist Society teleforum, whether as a speaker or as one of the participants as a listener. And I have to say at the outset that I'm hardly a superb expert on the EEOC versus Abercrombie & Fitch case. I've read about it. I've read about the case in the newspapers, and I've read the opinions, of course. But it is certainly my hope, as Dean suggested, that others on the line have intelligent and insightful views about the case, and that my opening remarks will just be the beginning of a dialogue that we can have amongst people on the phone about the case and about its implications. The thing I really like about the case is that it really highlights some of Title VII's very unique aspects. One of the most important aspects of Title VII, and unique aspects, I think, is that motives count under Title VII. And it's different from most statutes in that regard. If you have a statute against assault and you hit someone, the only intent that counts is whether you intended to hit them. Under Title VII, the same conduct, intentional conduct, can be legal or not legal depending upon the person's motives. So if I refuse to hire someone, that could be perfectly legal if my reason for not hiring them was not one of the prescribed reasons. But on the other hand, if I do not hire the person for a prescribed reason, because that person is black or because that person is a woman, then I've violated Title VII, along if other elements of the tort are met. So you might say that Title VII tries to look into people's heart and see what's there. The other interesting part about Title VII is that it's not always the case that reality matters. If I refuse to hire a white person because I think that white person is Hispanic, that is just as bad as not hiring a Hispanic whom I believe to be Hispanic because they are Hispanic. The motive is what counts, and I think that really comes to the fore when we're discussing this particular case. And the third part about Title VII's unique aspects, and it relates specifically to discrimination against religion. Unlike discrimination on the basis of race or on the basis of sex or on the basis of ethnicity, discrimination against religion is more broadly defined. It's not merely discrimination against someone because of that person's membership in a religion. It is discrimination against someone because of that person's religious practices. Now, what exactly does it mean to discriminate against a religious practice? And that's the question that this case tried to answer. So let's briefly go through the facts. The case is called EEOC versus Abercrombie and Fitch, but EEOC was the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission was suing on behalf of a young Muslim woman whose name is Samantha Alouf. I hope I pronounced that correctly. She was a 17-year-old woman who applied in her local mall for a job at Abercrombie & Fitch as a sales clerk, what Abercrombie & Fitch calls a sales model. ANF, that's what I'll refer to Abercrombie & Fitch now, ANF has this policy called the look policy. Sales models, and indeed all ANF employees, have to have the right look. They have to dress correctly with clothes very similar to the clothes they sell at ANF, which is supposed to attract ANF's target audience. And I suspect if you're on this phone and you are either a lawyer or in law school, you're probably outside of ANF's target audience because, well, you're too old. ANF doesn't do traditional advertising. Marketing depends upon what is called, and I love this phrase, a holistically brand-based sensory experience. That's a quote from the Tenth Circuit case. A holistically brand-based sensory experience in the store. Ms. Alauf applied for the job. During her interview, she wore a black hijab, a traditional head covering worn by Muslim women. Her interviewer believed that she was wearing it for a religious reason, but there was no discussion about it at all in the interview. After consulting with higher-ups, the interviewer, or someone higher-up, decided not to hire Ms. Alauf because her job would violate the look policy. More on that towards the end of my introduction. The EEOC sued on her behalf. The district court granted summary judgment to the EEOC. The Tenth Circuit not only reversed that grant of summary judgment, but also granted summary judgment to ANF, holding that an employer in a religious accommodation case must have knowledge that the practice is religiously based and that the applicant would like an accommodation. And since there was no evidence that Ms. Alauf communicated the fact that her wearing of the hijab was a religiously based practice and that she would like an accommodation, the Tenth Circuit held that summary judgment should have been granted to ANF. So the case goes up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court holds, interestingly enough, that Title VII is very much like religion. It's not about knowledge. It's all about beliefs. So let's go again just briefly to the language of Title VII. The relevant provision of Title VII says it is illegal, unlawful, to fail or refuse to hire or discharge any individual because of such individual's religion. The word religion is subsequently defined in Title VII, or actually it's not subsequently, but previously defined in Title VII to include all aspects of religious observance and practice as well as belief. Unless an employer demonstrates that he is unable to reasonably accommodate to a religious observance or practice without undue hardship on the conduct of the employer's business. So what are the possibilities of discrimination against a religious practice? Well, you could discriminate against a practice without knowing that it's religious. I see someone wearing a Mets hat. Much to my surprise, it turns out that he's wearing a Mets hat for some religious reason. I've nonetheless discriminated. I've chosen not to hire them because he's wearing the Mets hat. That's a possible answer. It's one that everyone rejects because Title VII, after all, is designed, as I said earlier, to combat improper motives. A second possibility, and this is the one that the court ultimately adopts, is that it prohibits employers from discriminating against a practice which the employer believes to be a religious practice and which it does not want to accommodate. A third possibility, and this one I think that Justice Alito sort of adopted, is that it precludes discrimination against a religious practice, or against a practice, I should say, that the employer knows to be religiously motivated. A fourth possibility is the one the Tenth Circuit had, which is that the employer cannot discriminate against a practice that it knows to be religious and knows that the that the employee wants to have accommodated, because after all, somebody could show up in a kippah and the employer might know that the person is Jewish, but might not know, for example, that the employee would like to be off on Saturdays unless the employee lets the employer know. That's the Tenth Circuit's position. And finally, there's Justice Thomas's position, which was that a practice is a religious practice. The employer has discriminated against a religious practice if it has discriminated against the practice because it is religious. That is to say, it will allow people to wear hats or head coverings, but it will not allow people to wear yarmulkes. That is to say, it treats religious practices less well than it treats other practices that are identical but not motivated by religion. So the court goes through the language of the statute, and it comes to the conclusion that Title VII doesn't have, as the Tenth Circuit held, anything to do with knowledge. We don't care about knowledge, we just care about beliefs. Title VII has always been about motivation, and a motivation does not have to be based upon certainty. It needs to be based upon the employer's belief. And if the employer believes that a practice is religiously motivated, and the employer engages in an adverse employment action because of that religious practice, and because it doesn't want to accommodate the religious practice, then the employer has violated Title VII. I just wanted to briefly comment about a couple of things and then have a few closing notes before I open it up to questions. First, Justice Alito and the majority opinion, by the way, was written by Justice Scalia, so this is one of those interesting cases where we have Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas on opposite sides, and Justice Alito sort of in the middle. Justice Alito and Justice Scalia's opinion for the majority seem to be disputing one another, but I have actually some doubts as to whether they are. Justice Scalia says Title VII prohibits beliefs, but it sort of concedes at the end that a belief has to be based upon something. And so, therefore, a belief can be based upon a suspicion or upon knowledge that a practice is religiously motivated. And I don't really understand Justice Alito to be saying anything that much different than the majority. The majority, I guess, doesn't specifically say that there needs to be this knowledge or suspicion. They sort of leave the question open, but it's pretty clear from their opinion that there does have to be some basis for the belief, because, well, I mean, there's always a basis for a belief. The other thing I wanted to mention is Justice Thomas's position, which is really quite out there, and I think actually not correct. Justice Thomas's position is that only those actions which are discrimination against a religious practice, that is to say, treating a religious practice less favorably than an identical practice not religiously motivated, violates the intentional discrimination provisions of Title VII. And I don't think that's right, and I think Justice Alito addressed why it's not right, because there really wouldn't be any reason for the accommodation provision of Title VII. That is to say, the employer has an affirmative defense of showing that accommodating a specific religious practice would be an undue burden. There would be no reason for that particular defense if the employer could just say, well, I'm treating all people who engage in this practice, religiously motivated and not religiously motivated, the same. And I think that's right. I think Justice Thomas's position here is not well-founded. I had a few closing notes, and maybe I'll mention them during the course of our discussion. But I think since I've been talking now for about 15 minutes, Dean, why don't I throw it back to you and see if there's anyone out there who'd like to have a discussion about this lovely case.
All right. Let's open it up for questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for Mr. Rossman, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to our audience, we are getting quite a few questions here. Let me make a couple announcements. First, the third annual Executive Branch Review Conference will be hosted here in Washington, D.C. at the Mayflower Hotel on June 18th. We're adding speakers almost daily to this day-long conference. There's no cost to attend, and I encourage you to take a look at our website for additional details, but that's June 18th here in Washington, D.C., and I would let folks know that for the second annual conference last year, people did begin to travel in from out of town to attend this conference, so I encourage you to take a look. In terms of upcoming Teleform conference calls, tomorrow at noon, we'll be talking about free speech and license plates, customized license plates, with Professor Eugene Volokh. Then on Thursday, we'll be visiting with Professors Richard Epstein and Ilya Soman. We'll be discussing Professor Soman's new book, The Grasping Hand, which marks the 10th anniversary of the Kelo case. Friday, tentatively scheduled for 4 p.m., but quite possibly going to move the time of day of that, but still have it on Friday. Another Courthouse Steps teleform, this one a discussion of the Onus Facebook threats case decided yesterday by the court. Today, of course, Michael Rossman, and we're talking about the Abercrombie & Fitch case. Let's go to our first caller of the day.
Let me just say, Dean, that sounds like a terrific lineup for the week.
Well, it sounds like we might have you hooked in for some of these, Michael.
I may be listening, yeah.
Hi, Bob Fitzpatrick, Washington, D.C. I have a couple of quick questions, if I may. In footnote 3 of Justice Scalia's opinion, they specifically punt and say, we're not going to resolve the question of there's no knowledge, there's no suspicion, there's no assumption, there's no guess. You simply do not know that whatever it may be, let's say a tattoo, which has religious, sincerely held religious significance to the job applicant. We're not deciding what test applies in those circumstances. I have to believe that there's 5 votes there that knowledge, assumptions, suspicion, a guess, that religion had to be in the stew in the discussions to reject the person, and that therefore the only alternative left to a plaintiff would be to approach that example as a disparate impact case. And I assume disparate impact analysis is still applicable in religion cases.
I agree with that completely, by the way. I think I tried to convey that during my opening remarks. In order for something to be a motive, it strikes me that you have to have some kind of knowledge, maybe not complete certainty, but you have to have something to base your belief that someone is engaging in a religious practice.
But seemingly odd that they could not find it in footnote 3 within themselves to say that.
Yeah, it is odd.
To suggest
and you know,
votes.
Let me give you a little. The other odd thing about footnote 3 is that they say the issue isn't presented in the case since Abercrombie knew or suspected that the scarf was worn for religious reasons. Well, that actually was a disputed fact.
Right.
What happened is that the interviewer believed that religion was the reason why Ms. Alof was wearing the hijab, but she went upstairs. She consulted with hires up, and there was a dispute as to whether she ever conveyed her suspicion to the hires up.
Right.
And Abercrombie argued in the Tenth Circuit that Abercrombie, didn't know or even suspect that is to say the decision maker, the higher up who made the decision not to hire, that the practice was a religiously motivated practice. And Justice Alito points this out in his concurrence. So it's a very odd sentence there in the middle of three, and it's even odder for the reason you say. It does suggest it's odd that they don't just come out and say, well, of course there has to be some kind of knowledge in order for there to be a belief at all.
Let me ask if I could also.
Sure.
I think it's footnote 2 that starts with Scalia taking a pot shot at Justice Alito, saying mysteriously the concurrence rejects the notion that the plaintiff has the burden of proof on the accommodation issue. And Justice Alito pushes back on that in his concurrence. I'm trying to parse it out and figure out is how do you read that? And I guess the big question is, does plaintiff have to establish that not only there is an accommodation, but that the accommodation does not have an undue hardship on the employer, which the scathing footnote 2 seems to suggest. And once again, it's surprising that Kagan and company would have signed off on such a notion.
I don't think that's what they're saying. Again, this is a part where I think Alito and the majority are actually sparring over semantics. So what the majority is saying here, I believe, is that failing to hire someone because of a religious practice is a failure to accommodate that practice. By definition, by not hiring them, you're not accommodating them. The burden that shifts to the employer is not that they didn't accommodate, but that accommodating would be an undue burden. And I don't think the majority is saying that it is the plaintiff's burden to show that it would not be an undue burden to accommodate the religious practice. I don't think that's what they're saying. I think they're just saying if you don't hire someone, you're not accommodating them, which is, you know, true.
Last question. I'm sorry to take up so much time. The but-for motivating factor discussion.
Yeah.
Is it your reading that there are on a disparate treatment case that there are two methodologies? You can either prove, and I don't know why. Well, yes, I do. That there are two methodologies. One is but for, the other alternative is to merely show motivating factor, or is the test but for a motivating factor, that they've morphed the two together?
I don't think they've morphed the two together. So here's my view, and it actually raises an interesting constitutional question. So Title VII says it doesn't matter whether the employer would have made the same decision. That is to say, even if the employer would not have hired Ms. Aloff anyway because she wasn't qualified or they didn't like her, she didn't present well for whatever reason, it doesn't matter as long as a discriminatory motive was a, quote, motivating factor, unquote. You have violated Title VII. And Title VII's kind of unique in that regard. I mean, if you think, for example, about Mount Healthy and cases involving the First Amendment, if the defendant shows that they would have done the same thing in the absence of the improper motive, the defendant wins. Under Title VII, if the defendant shows they would have done the same thing in the absence of an improper motive, the plaintiff still wins. It's just that the plaintiff can't get certain kinds of damages, like you can't get back pay or front pay or anything like that. But you can still get nominal damages, emotional distress damages, perhaps attorney's fees. And the interesting part about that the court, I don't think, has ever really addressed is, does that person who is not really harmed by the discrimination, because the employer would have done the same thing, really have standing? The underlying supposition of Title VII is that they do. So to answer your question, I think motivating factor is something different than but-for causation, and it's intentionally been made different from but-for causation. The plaintiff has a lower burden under Title VII.
Okay. Thanks ever so much.
Thank you, Bob. Good question.
We've got four questions, well, three questions pending now. Let's go to our next caller.
We lost one, huh?
We lost one, but now we've gained another one, so five total. Here we go with
all
the
right.
Next.
This is Roger Clegg with the Center for Equal Opportunity. I'm also
Hello, Roger.
How are you doing?
I'm all right.
Good. I should tell the audience I'm also the president of the Northern Virginia chapter of the Michael Rossman Fan Club.
Oh, that's so sweet. And I might add all of the other chapters, too.
My question is this. Is this a very narrow and fairly unimportant decision, or as you were reading through it, did you come across bits and pieces where you said to yourself, aha, this is going to be very significant, down the pike in this, more important Title VII context, or even this gives us clues as to how Justice Scalia is going to read other statutes where similar issues like disparate impact issues might be involved.
Well, that's a good question, and I think Roger, if I'm understanding your question correctly, you're sort of asking me what kind of practical importance and/or implications we can derive from this. And I think to answer the second part first. Justice Scalia makes clear at the end of his opinion that religion is kind of sui generis. He says, all of these other, what the dissent and the concurrence say may be true for these other prohibited criteria under Title VII, but Title VII doesn't require mere neutrality with respect to religion. It requires that it be treated better. It requires religious practices to be treated better.
It's like a disability.
Which is not in Title VII. But yeah, exactly. But it's very much like disability in that regard. And indeed, the Tenth Circuit, in its opinion, tried to make an analogy to disability. So to answer the question, I don't think that this is going to have a lot of legs for other kinds of disparate treatment cases. And I really don't think it's – because he views this as a disparate treatment case, albeit a sui generis one because it involves religion. I don't think it's going to have much to do with disparate impact. I do want to just your question leads into one of the little asides I wanted to make in closing but didn't have time to do. In today's Washington Post, Gregory Lipper, who is the senior litigation counsel for the Americans United for Separation of Church and State, praises the opinion. He says, it makes it clear that employers can't put their head in the sand, blah, 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 blah. And I was just thinking, given Justice Scalia's closing to this opinion, that it requires that religion be favored over other kinds of practices. Religious practices have to be favored over other kinds of practices. That is very odd that the Americans United for Separation of Church and State would actually support the result. I would have thought they'd be against any law that required religion be favored, but what do I know, right? Now I want to go back to the other part of the question, or how I viewed it, which is, what practical importance will this have? And I think in the religious accommodation context, it is going to have some practical importance because I think most of the circuit courts had viewed that there be some kind of knowledge requirement, and some, like the Tenth Circuit, also require not only knowledge that the practice in question was a religious practice, but that the employee would want an accommodation. That part, it strikes me, has been sort of knocked out pretty clearly by the Supreme Court's opinion. So it's going to make it a little easier for people who, especially people who weren't hired, because that's, I think, where this is going to come in most, to make their cases of religious discrimination, intentional religious discrimination. Can I ask you a question, Roger?
Sure.
So Justice Thomas says, well, this isn't an intentional discrimination case at all. And I was wondering, since you have a very detailed and expert knowledge of the distinction between disparate treatment and disparate impact, whether you had any thoughts about whether Justice Thomas was correct.
You know, I don't. I did when I was reading it. You know.
Okay, then get off the phone. Okay.
<I'm kidding. laughs>
No, seriously, go
phone.
Ahead.
But no, I really don't have an opinion on that. Maybe I should get off the phone. I think that, you know, it's very tricky. Well, you and I have talked about. That there are some cases where, you know, for instance, with, you know, unconscious disparate treatment, is unconscious disparate treatment really disparate impact? Because, you know, the intent part is lacking. You know, I think that there are some interesting, you know, issues there. But I, as for what Justice Thomas said specifically, I can't say whether he was right or wrong. Sorry.
Okay.
Very what do you think? What do you think?
You know, I think that this is. I think religious accommodation cases are. They seem to be defined in Title VII as a disparate treatment case. So even though we don't really think of them as disparate treatment cases, or for that matter, failure to accommodate handicap as disparate treatment, that's what Congress has said. So they are. And whether or not they would, the interesting question is whether or not compensatory damages should be available under them. And on that, I'm more open to Justice Thomas's thoughts about that, because the way intentional discrimination is defined in the statute might make it possible that he's right. But I'm uncertain.
I mean, I suppose you could have situations, you know, some situations where the failure to make a reasonable accommodation, you know, if it's done deliberately.
Right.
You know, he would say that, well, yeah, that might be disparate treatment. Whereas, you know, if you just are sort of unaware that your failure to make this reasonable accommodation is having a disparate impact, then that looks more like, you know, disparate impact.
Mm-hmm.
Well, gentlemen, we've got five questions. Thank you, Roger. We've got five questions pending. Let's take our next call here.
Hi, everybody. My name is Rafi Melkoni, and I'm an appellate lawyer in Houston. What I thought was interesting about this case, let me just throw my comment out there and see what people think, and it follows a little along what we were just talking about, is that to me it exposes a really interesting distinction among or tension between sort of the conservative judges on the circuits and in the Supreme Court. Because on one hand, representing a Title VII plaintiff is a really good way to lose. I mean, especially here in the Fifth Circuit where I practice. On the other hand, where there's a religious claim involved, like here, you get a lot more traction. And I think, to me, that's part of the remarkable run that religious protections have had in the Supreme Court in the last couple of years. And so, to me, it seems like sort of religion is winning over the court's natural skepticism of employment discrimination claims, and I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I mean, I think there's something to that, but I think it's a statutorily based, as we were discussing before, it's a statutorily based advantage that it has. There's no such thing as a race practice, but there is a religious practice, and the statute says let's not discriminate against religious practices, and we have to decide what that means. Now, I think, you know, obviously, if they really wanted to protect religion, they could have gone to the strict liability interpretation of that phrase, a practice which is religious unbeknownst to the employer. They didn't go that far, but they did have to come up with some interpretation as to what it means to discriminate against a religious practice, and they did have to say something about what is in the employer's mind in order to make it discrimination against religious practice. So, I mean, I think that the point you make is good, that the religion seems to be doing well, but different statutes have different requirements to them, and I think the advantage that religion has in the Title VII context is a statute-based advantage.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Rafi. Good question.
If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we've got plenty of time left. Let's go to our next caller now.
Good afternoon, Mr. Rossman. Thanks so much for your kind and thoughtful remarks. I'm Eric Lippman. I'm an administrative law judge in Minnesota. My question for you has to do with the apparent disconnect between the underlying regulation on reasonable accommodation and the court's opinion yesterday. If one were to read Part 1605 on reasonable accommodation, it says that after a prospective employee, here Ms. Eloff, notifies the employer of his or her need for a religious accommodation, the employer must accommodate. Justice Scalia suggested or wrote yesterday that an employer who acts with a motive of avoiding the accommodation may violate Title VII if he has no more than an unsubstantiated suspicion that an accommodation is needed. To my mind, there's a disconnect because it's much harder if I were to survive a summary judgment from the employer, if I were to say I gave notice, as opposed to I think the employer had an unsubstantiated opinion. Easier for me to make a disputed issue of material fact on the second question rather than what the regulation implies is required, which is I need one. And I thought that my own sense was that the court would wrestle with whether arriving as Ms. Eloff did was notice enough. They didn't seem to touch that question. I was wondering if you might.
Well, I mean that was the district court's view in the case was that arriving as she did convey notice, and the Tenth Circuit I guess disagreed because they wanted something a little more than notice. I don't know that I have a good answer to your question, Mr. Lippman, because I think what happened here is that the EEOC's regulations were sort of viewed as, well, that's, you know, the EEOC was one of the litigants here. So this is just sort of like their litigation position. And, you know, at best they were used by Justice Thomas quite repeatedly as pointing out that, the EEOC had a different position as to this requirement of notice prior to the case coming before the Supreme Court. So I think the phenomena that you've described was merely the Supreme Court deciding that it would interpret the statute rather than the EEOC, one of the litigants before it. I don't know that I have a better answer for you than that.
Thanks for your time.
You have a view.
My own view is I think they've made a hash of it. At some level I'm delighted that Ms. Eloff won. I think it's as the AP reported today, you know, the gal with the headscarf won, you know, and so joy be to that. But if employers are in fact reading the regulation and trying to understand what the words actually mean, I think it's not a great day for originalism. How's that?
That's a fair question. I'm not sure they were trying to be originalists so much as they were trying to be textualists here. And maybe that's there's a difference there that was dispositive. Let me ask you a question since you've raised this that the popular press says that she won, and of course she did win in the sense that the Tenth Circuit's judgment was vacated. But did the court instruct the Tenth Circuit to grant her summary judgment as the district court had done?
I have to look back, but it's my recollection that that it goes back and that the summary judgment in favor of Abercrombie is vacated. And
right,
so,
that's vacated, but I don't see, even though there's lots of things that you would be able to use on remand, I still think that the case is open once the Tenth Circuit gets the case back upon remand, and there's various, conceivably Abercrombie could go back, although that sentence in footnote 3 I quoted earlier may seem to the contrary. Abercrombie can go back and say the person who made the decision had no idea that her wearing of the hijab was a religiously motivated practice. So, interesting.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Hi, this is Roger Severino from the DeVos Center at the Heritage Foundation. Two questions. What if the plaintiff was willing to take off the hijab but was denied because Abercrombie believed she would ask for an accommodation? So it's a mistaken perception. Would she still have a claim?
Yeah, that's a, you know, there's this sentence. I gotta read it now, Mr. Severino, since you said it. Justice Scalia says, if the applicant actually requires an accommodation of that religious practice, and the employer's desire to avoid the prospective accommodation is a motivating factor in his decision, the employer violates Title VII. Now, as I read that, I said, well, what does the first part of it have to do with it, if the applicant actually requires an accommodation? What if the applicant doesn't actually require an accommodation, but the employer doesn't know it? It strikes me that the rest of the opinion, other than that one sentence, that the rest of the opinion says the employer is still liable. It doesn't matter whether the applicant does or doesn't actually require an accommodation. It only matters what the employer's motive was. Anyway, that's how, other than that one sentence, that's how I read the opinion. But if maybe you have some other parts of the opinion that I'm missing.
No, and I think in the race context, if somebody mistakenly says, I don't like you because you're African-American, and they turn out to be something other than African-American and are fired for that, they would have a claim.
Of course, the employee would have a claim. Clearly, that's true. Yeah. That perceived race, perceived religion, perceived everything is what matters under Title VII. Yeah.
A perceived accommodation they want to avoid would seem to hang together with
that. Yeah, that's why I found that one sentence I read for you puzzling. It seems inconsistent with much of the rest of the opinion.
So in the last page, Scalia states that employers have an affirmative obligation, which I thought that language was notable.
Yeah.
To accommodate, and I interpret that employees cannot be willfully ignorant of the religious beliefs of the applicant that they suspect are there. They can't just say, I don't want to deal with it, I won't ask any questions. Do you think that employers now, for litigation postures, they would adopt policies where they would routinely ask if anyone needs accommodations? I think
I think they should. If I'm the EEOC has all of these, you know, things, never ask about anyone's religion, blah, 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 blah. But it seems to me you're absolutely right that a wisely advised employer at this point in time should be told if they have a suspicion that somebody is has a religious practice that might be inconsistent with their rules, they should talk to them about it, because somebody will say, oh my gosh, they suspected, they saw me, right? Because that's really all Ms. Alaf had. They saw me and they believed, and therefore they violated Title VII. So I'm with you on that. I think that a wisely advised employer should ask a few questions during the interview.
Yeah, I suspect this will start to come up more as the marriage issue heats up, where people who hold to the original definition of marriage are going to want accommodations in the workplace. So I like the affirmatively obligated language, so that should be helpful there.
Yeah. Yes, is that the language that I was trying to refer to before when I commented upon the Americans United for Separation of Church and State's puzzling approval of this opinion? Anyway, or at least it was puzzling.
This is Dean Reuter. Does that, an employer asking about an accommodation, does that put an employer really in an untenable position? I could see a case developing from those lines of questions, maybe inartfully asked, or maybe asked as well as you can ask, that leads to a suggestion that you didn't hire somebody because in asking those questions, you learned that they were a member of a certain religion.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't given it great thought, but it seems to me at some point before making a final. So it could be the case, for example, that you've decided to hire them, except that you're concerned about whether or not they have a religious practice that would violate one of your policies, and it's only then that you should ask, rather than during the initial interview. You know, maybe you should first see whether there are other reasons why you would not hire this person before you start worrying about whether or not they would place an undue burden on a policy because of their religious practices. I haven't I haven't given it great thought, I have to say, Dean. But I do acknowledge that you're that the employer is going to be walking a thin line, I guess.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We have but one question remaining at this point. We've got about 15 minutes, so we've got some time. Let's take another call.
Hi, Bob Fitzpatrick again. Sorry, I have another question, but you just actually started with the last caller and with Dean into what I've kind of characterized as you're kind of between the devil and the deep blue sea now. And I'm looking on my cell phone at one of the first takeaway advice columns from a management blog. And it's saying, if you are, and I'll recharacterize it, if you are deaf, dumb, and blind, in other words, you have no knowledge, no suspicion, no guess, no nothing, you're just totally unaware that this person has a religious practice, even though it might be staring you right in your face. You're just simply unaware. The management advice in this particular blog says, if so, ask the applicant whether he or she would need an accommodation, blah, blah, blah. And it seems to me that's the real takeaway debate from this case in terms of practice for employers. Are employers now choices deaf, dumb, and blind? Is that a safer safe harbor, if you will, or is it safer to, once you've gotten to the conditional hire, everything else is good, to then say, okay, and don't you have to reveal to the person all of your policies? You know, we work on Saturdays. We don't permit the wearing of caps. We don't permit visible tattoos, et cetera, et cetera. It just as a practical matter, how are you going to be able to have a fulsome discussion with the job applicant as to whether they have a religious belief, religious practice that conflicts with the way you run your business? I think I vote myself for deaf, dumb, and blind, but
here's what I would suggest about deaf, dumb, and blind. You have to convince the trier of fact that you are deaf, dumb, and blind. And from today's decision, that's not going to be all that easy, because that was certainly kind of Abercrombie's defense. We didn't know. One person knew, and then the decision maker didn't know, and I guess it wasn't deaf, dumb, and blind so much as, well, she just had a suspicion, and that's not good enough. And I think if somebody shows up with a hijab or with a kippah, a yarmulke on their heads.
Yeah, those seem.
Or, it's Ash Wednesday and they have Ash on.
Right.
Seems to me that saying, well, I didn't know what I was there for, is going to be lacking in credibility.
That I totally agree. But let's go to my tattoo example. I see the tattoo. I have not a clue in the world that whatever the symbol is on the tattoo has.
Oh, yeah, if it's not obvious, don't make inquiries. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So deaf, dumb, and blind, unless except to the simple-minded, a yarmulke, ashes, et cetera.
Right, right. I mean, obviously there are some that are just obviously, it's sort of common knowledge that they are religious practices. But if it's some obscure religious practice, by all means, I think you could easily defend yourself by saying,
And if there's nothing that you see or nothing that is said by the person, then am I hearing you right that your takeaway is you do not need, as this management blog seems to be suggesting, to say, okay, Do you believe in anything? Do you practice anything religious-wise that might somehow impede your ability to work for us? Kind of the disability question. And that's not a place I would be telling my clients to go.
Yeah.
It just opens Pandora's box.
I agree with you, Bob. I agree with you on that. If
sorry
if there's nothing
to go
obvious,
on.
You know, you don't need to court trouble.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Let me make a final call for questions. If you've got another question or if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've still got a few minutes left here.
Well, I'll make one last aside while we're seeing whether anyone wants to ring in, which is this. One of the facts of the case I found so interesting is that prior to applying for the job, Ms. Olaf, she had a friend who worked in the store. And she said, well, you know, is my hijab going to be any problem? And the friend made some inquiries up the line, and the answer was, no, shouldn't be any problem. We can make an accommodation for it so long as you don't, as long as it's not black. Because after all, part of the look policy is no black. You can't wear black. And interestingly enough, she went to the interview with a black hijab. So I don't know what this says, except, you know, 17-year-old women or men, for that matter, are unfamiliar with how to get ahead in this world. So. And I'll leave that for other people to contradict.
Okay. Well, we don't have another question pending. So,
all right, great.
Why don't we adjourn? I want to thank you, Michael Rossman, for your time
and
for your comments. This has been most enjoyable. To our audience, thank you as well for dialing in. A reminder about our next scheduled Teleforum conference call. That's tomorrow at noon when we'll be talking with Professor Eugene Volokh about the speech license plate case. But until that next call, we're adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.